Quanto mais você ouve podcasts, mais aprende sobre o mundo. É a prova de que a experiência é o que nos faz mais fortes. E esse é também o princípio da Ford, para criar as picapes com DNA raça forte, que valorizam cada quilômetro rodado e que constroem um verdadeiro legado. Essa é a nossa força. Paz no trânsito começa por você.
Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors. I'm your host, Saran, and today's guest is Marty Hott. Marty, do you want to say hi?
Hello.
You are a director at Ruby Central, which is a nonprofit that does a lot of stuff, actually. Do you want to tell us a bit about it?
Certainly. So I am a director of Ruby Central, along with two other directors, Evan Phoenix and Sarah May. And the three of us run the operations. We're the leaders or the people in charge of the organization. We also have two people that are full-time on staff to help with logistics and other running of the organization. The main thing that we're known for is that we organize RubyConf and RailsConf. The big sort of flagship conferences in the Ruby community. And we also run infrastructure for Ruby gems. So whenever you run any sort of gem command, it's our code and our servers that will make that work.
So far on the show, we've had mostly newer programmers telling us about their journey, how they got into programming, how they've developed professionally. And a big part of being a developer and being in this industry is going to and speaking at tech conferences. For someone who's never been to one before, doesn't know what to expect, what is a tech conference?
Well, I can tell you what sort of the Ruby tech conferences are. Tech conferences in general can span quite a wide array of experiences. Some are very small. I've seen events that are, 40 or less people, which I don't know if you really call that a conference. And I've seen them get very, very large. I spoke at an Agile conference in 2010, and it was like 2,000 people and 18 tracks. And it was just crazy, insane. I was overwhelmed and, with all the different places you can go and all the people speaking. Ruby conferences in general are a little more developer-centric. They're meant more for exchanging ideas, learning, connecting with other developers, other peers in the industry. And primarily, these conferences focus on people working in the Ruby language. But there are conferences out there that are they're multi-language. They cover maybe a specific niche of topics. Maybe they don't. There are lots of conferences out there that are more about marketing or about selling things like services. And they're usually the conferences that you probably won't enjoy unless you are either looking to buy services, probably at some sort of corporation where you're, looking for vendors for something or whatnot. But luckily, and for the people listening to this podcast, most likely, the Ruby conferences are really built for you. They're built for anyone who is interested in this case, the Ruby programming language, and also just being a developer in general and all the things that kind of come with that.
So when you say it's developer-centric, what does that mean?
Well, the program, which is the collection of all the talks and anything that the organizers are planning, the main purpose of all that program is for the developers, the attendees. That's who they're mainly developers, and they're there for your benefit. So the content will be maybe about learning some technique or a library or something like that, or some different way of working, just basically exposing you to new ideas or giving you different skills that will help you be better at Ruby.
When I first got into tech, conferences seemed like such an important part of being a developer. Why are they such a big deal? Why are they such a big part of the community?
Well, I mean, if you think about what community is, that's people coming together in some form or another. We have, at this point, with the internet and the way things are, you can connect with people without being physically in the same space. But before that, that wasn't possible. And there are some things that are better experienced in person when you can go up and talk to somebody face to face. And tech conferences really fit that the best. Like you can go, you can see lots of people, you might see some of your favorite authors of libraries or frameworks or whatnot. They will be there. Other maybe friends you've met or acquaintances you've made over the internet might be at the conference as well, and that's pretty exciting. And you can connect. I mean, you can talk to them in the hallway, which is called the hallway track, where you know you between sessions and breaks and whatnot, you can have interesting conversations about whatever might you might want to hear about, or you know, you have a question or something. And a lot of times it's people talking shop. So it could be complaining about something that happened on one of their projects or talking about some challenging issue that they just figured out, you know, implementing some library or integrating with some service or whatnot. And that's very fascinating because you might have that question too. And you're like, I would love to, you know, listen to that or even weigh in and have be part of that conversation. And that stuff happens all the time at these conferences. So if you think about what community is, it's really distilled down to these tech conferences. And if you weren't to go to them, you know, then you're really kind of missing a piece that you could be gaining otherwise. Like, I mean, are you going to read only Twitter or, you know, looking at mailing lists or maybe just being completely isolated where all you're doing is going to tutorials online or maybe watching some videos or whatever it might be, but you're not really connecting with anyone. You're not really having a conversation to ask those questions that isn't really, you know, you can't really ask them online, you know, at least you may not feel like you can, but you can when you're in person with somebody.
I think that's what makes tech conferences so awesome, but also overwhelming. There's so much to do. There's so much going on. There's the talks, and then there's the people that maybe you've seen online, seen on Twitter, and now you can finally connect. And then there's the impromptu things that happen, like the after parties and whatnot. As a first-time conference goer, how can you make the most out of a tech conference?
Well, I think it comes down to what are you comfortable with. The great thing about it is you can do as much or as little as you feel comfortable with, and that's okay. Certainly, I'm a bit more outgoing, and I am not as daunted about going up and talking to people I don't know. But there's lots of people out there, you know, in the tech community that's not the case. They may be nervous. They may not feel comfortable going up and talking to people. And it's okay if you don't. I mean, I would encourage that you do. The people there, they're normal people too. They, even though someone may have written some really big library, that doesn't mean that that person isn't approachable, that wouldn't enjoy having a chat with you. Or if you have a burning question, do you want to ask them about something or ask her about something, then that's fine. Go up and have that, ask that question. They're a lot more approachable than they might seem.
I like the way you started that because you said it's all about what you're comfortable with. And to be honest, I was terrified of the idea of going to a tech conference because I'd heard not so great things about it, especially as a woman and a person of color and being a new programmer. I thought, holy crap, worst case scenario, I was going to get harassed. Best case scenario, everything will be totally over my head and I won't know what's going on. And I actually made my fiance come with me for protection just in case. And luckily, RailsConf was the first conference I went to and it was incredible and nothing like what I thought it was going to be in the best way. But as an organizer, how do you make conferences a safe space for people who are underrepresented in this community and may not always feel welcome?
Well, I mean, the first thing is you have a code of conduct, which is vital because you're essentially laying out the rules of how people should behave. If you don't have one, then it's kind of like all bets are off. Like, well, you didn't say we couldn't be a jerk that way or whatever. And so code of conducts are very important. Certainly all my conferences have had one. And they don't have to be really complex, but they do have to set out the expectations. And pretty much there's a lot to them, and you can certainly read the ones that we have for our RailsConf and RubyConf, but they're pretty straightforward that basically be nice. You know, don't do things that are, well, first of all, you shouldn't do anything illegal. I think they all spell that out, that we all expect that. But basically, you should be nice. And if you're not going to follow the rules, then it kind of outlines what's going to happen in that case. And we also tell people, the rest of the attendees, that if you see something happening, if you see some issue, please come and let us know. We have, most conferences do, but certainly our conferences do, we have venue staff that can have access to the police. And if there is an issue that needs that sort of intervention, which I've never seen happen in any of my events, but if that were to happen, you do have a way of escalating it and having that get involved. So, but basically you know that the organizers have planned for that, or at least have a sense of how they're going to handle a situation, and that they've set out the expectations. Certainly when we open our conferences, I remind everyone about these policies. And for the most part, people just know to behave. And I think that the community has a way of behaving already. Like, so this is how we act in the Rubik community. So when you come in, you sort of learn about this as you sort of interact. And it's kind of cool in that people start behaving that way because that's how we always act around here. So by setting forth a good example, by setting out sort of these policies of how you should or shouldn't behave, then you allow for people who come in to just sort of acclimate to that, and they behave that way too. And it just sort of self-reinforces the good behavior.
I like that. That's why we do our CodeNB Twitter chats every week. We start off with 3 rules because we wanted to set the example and set the tone. You know, you're here because you want to be nice, you want to be helpful, and you want to be supportive. And if you want to troll or put anyone down, then this is not the place for you. And as soon as you put that message out, you get people who respond to that well. And then they bring their people who also respond to that well. And all of a sudden, you have a community of people who are there to truly learn and support each other. I think another barrier to entry is just price, right? Because conferences can be really expensive. And I know that if you're already a software developer, a lot of times your company will pay for it, or at least heavily subsidize it. But for a lot of code newbies who are learning to code outside of their day jobs, want to go to a conference and be part of that world, it can cost a lot.
Right.
How do you make conferences more financially accessible to those people?
Well, the first thing to kind of mention is that these events are fairly expensive to put on, especially the larger they get. The smaller they get, it's easier to be very affordable. The larger they get, it's not so easy because, you know, all the costs that go into having that large of a space, it's rough. So the larger conferences like the RailsConf type conferences are going to be expensive. And actually, the Ruby conferences in general are a lot more affordable than non-Ruby conferences out there. I mean, I've seen plenty of tech events that are $2,000, $3,000 just to get in. And that's pretty crazy. Yeah. So the first thing I would say is, first of all, ticket price is only one small facet of the cost. You're going to have travel, you're going to have lodging, and you know, you can kind of get around that if you're local or if you're nearby, or if you have friends in the area that you can maybe couch surf or something like that. That certainly helps with the costs. But you know, it is expensive if you're traveling to another area. It will add up, not just the ticket price, but other things. We try to keep ticket price as affordable as possible for the conferences. We don't, we're not a nonprofit, so we don't try to make money that way. Although we do use the proceeds from the conferences to fund the infrastructure for RubyConf and Rails, for RubyGems, I'm sorry. But but what I would say is look for smaller regional conferences that are closer to you, because they almost always have much lower prices. You know, some are as low as $100 for a couple day conference. And especially if they're regional or local, then you won't have the travel and the lodging. And there are a good number of conferences out there. So I would take a look for that as a more affordable first experience for a conference.
And I imagine that going to conferences that are hosted in smaller places, you know, not necessarily big cities, might be cheaper in terms of hotel and airplane tickets and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And we try to pick locations. When we pick where RubyConf and RailsConf will be, we move them around, by the way, every time. We try to be in different parts of the country. They're always in the U.S., so we're not an international conference in that regard. We don't move it outside of the United States, but inside the United States, we try to move around the different regions. We also try to pick places that will be, not too expensive, can support a conference of that size, has the amenities that makes the experience of going to the conference outside of just the sessions nice. It's sort of like lots of aspects to what we look for in a city. But we do try to pick where it's not too bad to get an airline ticket into there, and the expenses of getting to the venue is not too bad. And unfortunately, the larger cities, the lodging costs are a bit more expensive, but, you know, it's, you know, it's just, it's all part of the experience. So we try to balance it out if we can.
So you clearly have a lot to do and think about when you're putting on these conferences. Once you do a conference and it's all over and you're looking back at it, how do you define success?
Well, I want people to have a good time. I want people to be inspired, learn something, maybe connect with other peers at the event. You know, you can tell when things are going well because the energy level is just high. I don't want to say it's a big party because that maybe, I mean, it's kind of right, but it's not just about, you know, party, if you will, but it is about having a good time, feeling good, feeling inspired, maybe wanting to dive in deeper into something after, like, you have like all these things you want to check out when you're done. Those are the kinds of things I like to see from, you know, a conference experience. As an organizer, of course, I want nothing major to go wrong. There's always little things that pop up, but ultimately I want all those little issues to be invisible to the attendees. And ultimately, as long as they had a good time, then that's pretty much the measure of success.
When you stepped into the role of organizing a conference, were there things that you saw at other conferences that you didn't like or would have done differently and thought to yourself, this is what's going to be different about my conferences?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I had been encouraged because I'd started organizing Boulder Ruby at that point. I started that in January of 2006. And I was thinking about what I wanted. I mean, if I'm going to put all this work, and there's a lot of work that goes into it, if I'm going to put all this work, what do I really want? What am I going to try to accomplish with this conference? And I mean, initially I helped out with Mountain West, and Mountain West was the first regional conference because before that there actually weren't any regionals. It was all just RubyConf at that point. And it was interesting to see the regionals start to pop up all over the place. And, you know, 2007 was when a year where, I don't know, there were six or eight regionals that came to be in that year and continue on. So certainly in working with Mike and Pat on Mountain West, I saw what we were trying to accomplish, and I liked a lot of things. And then when I started Rocky Mountain Ruby in 2010, which was called Mountain.rb initially, I did think about what do I want to do with that. And one of the things that's very important for me when I was running a regional was I wanted to really exhibit the local area. So in this case, it was in Boulder. The conference felt very much like Boulder and had touches of Boulder that you would only find, like meditation. We did meditation in the morning, and we were doing a hike as part of it. And so it's very much like I want to kind of be the ambassador of the local community, as well as kind of bring in the cool Ruby, whatever, to the people in the area. Because a lot of people don't travel for the big conferences. So most of the attendees that went to Rocky Mountain Ruby, you know, had never been to a larger conference outside. And so I wanted to bring that experience to them. So, but, you know, but I also thought about, and I talked with other people who had done cool conferences and what worked for them. What did they really like about what they did? And I thought, did that work for my format? Could I pull that off? Would that work? And if I felt I could, I would add it in. I did like a pioneering card game the first year that I tried out. And it was a lot of fun. It was pretty cool. But I definitely did think a lot about, what am I trying to do? What am I trying to curate with this experience?
Was there ever an idea you were excited about that just totally bombed? Because I really want to hear that story.
Totally bombed.
Okay, kind of bombed, like medium bombed?
Well, I mean, so like with a card game, I underestimated how much work I had to do. And I was a solo organizer for the first year of Rocky Mountain Ruby. And I had gotten most of it in place, but there's some things I hadn't really thought about with the card game. And so I was going to write an app to help people score, but then I ran out of time. I realized like within 2 weeks, there's no way I could balance everything and get the scoring app written. So instead I wrote sort of like a requirements for a scoring game, and I let the attendees do it themselves. So I kind of turned what would have been sort of a disaster, like, hey, here's all these cards, you can kind of play this game, but there's no rules that have been published, and there's no way of, you know, like that hadn't been released. So it was like, okay, these are just, I guess, souvenirs, you know. And the other thing I didn't anticipate was that people would trade, they just give away cards. So all of a sudden, like the way I'd done play balancing in the card game was expecting that you would only have one pack to work with and that you would trade one for one or whatever. And there are lots of people that would just say, hey, I don't really care about this. Have my cards. And so it made that sort of interaction lopsided. But it didn't really matter because the important piece was it was an icebreaker. It was a, hey, here's something that will encourage people to talk to each other and to go up to somebody they didn't know and maybe trade cards or just, you know, laugh about whatever in regards to this card game.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of ended up being an accidental community building tool.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I was pleased with how it came out, but yeah, that was an example of something that I had, you know, it didn't kind of go as I expected, as I had planned, but it went well regardless. Like, it was cool to see how I winged the experience. It worked out for everyone and they had a good time. People have fond memories of it when I talk to them, you know, about that first conference.
I like how I asked you to tell me about a time where you failed and your answer was, well, I kind of failed, but not really, because I'm still awesome. That was well played. I respect that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about CFPs, which stands for Call for Proposals. Over the years, you've done not just RubyConf and RailsConf, but a lot of other regional conferences, as we talked about. How many CFPs have you read and reviewed over the years?
So in thinking about this, see, it goes back to 2007. I would guess I've been part of 15 conferences in terms of part of shaping the program, reviewing the CFP. And I would say at least 1,500 talks I've reviewed personally, maybe 2,000. And I'm not exactly certain, but I would guess in that realm. So a lot.
Wow, that's a lot of talks.
Yes, it is. And it's funny when you start to review it, it takes a good amount of time. I mean, you might be able to skim a proposal in, you know, 2 minutes, but you still need to kind of think about it more deeply, especially a larger call like a RailsConf. You get a lot of proposals that are very similar, and you'll see four talks that are, you know, virtually the same talk by different people, and you have to make a call. You can't put all of them in. And most likely you'll only put one in, because then why would you put in two talks that are almost the same, you know? So it's like, okay, now you have to really think about, okay, all the different ways one of these four talks will be the better fit for the conference.
Yeah. How do you make that call? What do you look at?
Well, I can tell you what I look at. I mean, the first thing that you need to understand when, you know, if you're submitting a proposal for a call, the thing that's most important is you're writing a talk that people want to go see. So if you're abstract, which is sort of the short blurb that would be in a program, which is kind of the little paragraph or two that someone might read to decide, oh, you know, they see the title of your talk and they see a little abstract to say, okay, that's what that talk's going to be. That the two of those things have to be compelling. Like, would you go to see that talk? Would it be interesting? If you're up against two or three other talks, because it's a multi-track conference, will that talk be interesting enough to get people to go to it? And if the answer is no, or if you don't, if it's kind of like, well, this could be okay, but I'm not really feeling it when I read this abstract or the title, then that's not going to go well for the attendees. So an organizer or the program committee will most likely, they'll tell when they've read something like, this is really exciting. I really want to see this talk. And you want to get that from a proposal. So if that's missing, then, you know, it's going to be hard, because you have to understand, especially with the larger conferences, that you're up against, what, 400 other talks, and that, you know, you're looking for any reason to give another talk the edge, because you've got maybe what, you know, we've got like 60-ish slots for 400 talks. So those aren't good odds. And so, I mean, there's that. There's just sort of this feel when you read it, like, this is not going to be interesting to attendees. That's one thing. Every conference has sort of the aim of its program. What is this conference doing? Why is it there? You know, with RubyConf, it's about sort of showcasing all the things that are happening in the Ruby community, you know, in terms of language, in terms of libraries, whatever it might be, just things around the ecosystem of Ruby. RailsConf is similar. It's anything related to RailsConf. We think about what would a RailsConf attendee or a Rails developer want to see or expect to see at that conference. So we try to identify what that is. And I'm pretty much sure that most conference organizers have that. They may not communicate it, but hopefully they do. Because, I mean, it's tough to write a good proposal if you don't know what the shape of the program is supposed to look like from the organizer's standpoint. So once you understand that, then you can decide whether or not you're writing a talk that fits the program. So like, for example, if someone did some talk about PHP SEO or something, they'd be like, well, that's not really what we would expect to see at RubyConf. So that pretty much isn't going to make the cut. So, I mean, the first thing is it topical? Is it of interest to the people that'll be at RubyConf?
So PHP at RailsConf, probably not a good idea for my next proposal.
Probably not. Although it can work. I mean, here are some interesting things that this other community or this other language is doing that you're not doing that is interesting. Because we don't want, at least I don't want, the conference just to be an echo chamber of what we're already doing. It's good to bring in new ideas and to get people thinking. It's okay to bring up a talk that is a bit more controversial or that not everyone agrees with, because what you want is you want a conversation to happen either during that talk or afterwards in the hallway about maybe we should reevaluate this, or maybe, no, that's a terrible, terrible idea, and here's why, and you get people discussing that, and that's what's really important, right? You want to see that sort of thing happen. Otherwise, it's like just pats on the back. Great, we're just so awesome, and here's all these libraries we have and whatever it might be. But then you're in isolation and you're not really connected with what's happening out in the greater tech community or whatnot. So you do want to bring that in. And of course, every organizer is different. Maybe they don't want that. Maybe they want to bring in weird, crazy stuff. And the more traditional classic talks might not be in because they want something that's really fringe. And but once you understand that, you need to decide if a talk is going to fit that.
What is the craziest, most fringe topic you've seen at a conference?
I don't know if I have an answer for that. I know I remember reading about a talk that it was used Ruby in a submarine. I mean, there's.
Ooh, that sounds awesome.
Right, and I think actually the RubyConf program this year has got. We actually have a track called Fringe Ruby that sort of highlights crazy, interesting things that people are doing with Ruby that is this definitely off the beaten path. And there's we got some stuff with like automating robots and music library type stuff. So I think there's one called Sweaters as a Service that's pretty cool. So just really, I mean, it's like there's, what are people doing that's interesting? And so, yeah, and you can read that actually on the RubyConf program page. You can read some of those talks out there right now.
Last year for RailsConf 2013, you did blind reviews for the first time. Tell us about that. How do blind reviews work?
Right. So for a while, and I think when I joined Ruby Central, I brought in the notion that we should be doing blind. And at that point, the community was talking about we should do blind because otherwise we're letting our biases creep in. And that definitely was a thing. And it wasn't so much like a gender or, skin color type issue, ethnicity. It's more like, well, this is my buddy. I know this guy or I like this person, so I'm going to weight their talk more favorably. And so the blind process, it removes any sort of identification of the actual speaker when you're first doing a pass on the talk. And so the software that we use for the CFP for both RubyConf and RailsConf, the reviewers can't see the speaker's bio, the speaker's name, any like that, unless the speaker... Sometimes they do this. They put like, and here's a link to my other talk or my other library. And if you follow that link, it's really clear who that person is. But beyond leaks like that, we actually have no idea who has submitted this talk. And it's great because then you're truly giving a first impression on a talk based solely on the content of the proposal and nothing else. And most of, I would say, sort of the selection process goes on without knowing who the people are. I mean, we, you know, a number, and usually in our case, we have a program committee of multiple people that are reviewing all these talks because there's so many talks to review. And so, you know, we at least get three or four reviews for every talk. And, you know, all the scores are kind of showing up and the speaker's identity isn't at all part of it. But later on in the process, we don't do it blind all the way to the end because there are factors that we want to take into consideration. If it's a new speaker or a very experienced speaker, or depending on what their background is, that might inform us of whether they've picked a topic that they can pull off or not pull off. Because sometimes there like maybe two or three talks that are great. They're written very well. They would appear to be a great talk, but if they're if somebody really doesn't know what they're talking about, or they're, you know, don't have a lot of experience speaking, we might say, gosh, that topic might be too hard for them to pull off. Like they might not be able to do a good job with that. And sometimes that's not an issue at all. But there are times when we will say, okay, yep, okay, we know that person. We can see that talk going well. So that might confirm the ratings that has been given.
How did that new process change the final speakers that you got compared to previous years?
Well, and we've published some numbers on this, and I don't have them in front of me, so I'm going to speak generally about this. Certainly, we saw an increase in first-time speakers. I think perhaps they were more encouraged to submit. I'm not really sure if that's true, but certainly a lot more first-time speakers we're seeing making into the program. The representation of women. I don't know about persons of color. First of all, we don't really track that data. And although we started to ask that in an optional way, most people don't even fill it out anyway. So it's kind of meaningless. Like we just don't have the numbers. So we have to kind of guess after the program is done, looking at who's in the program, what the percentages are. But I don't really have any numbers on that. Unfortunately, we don't get a lot of variety in diversity from people who are submitting. It's gotten better, but it's still like, you know, if you look at from a person of color standpoint, there's not a lot of talks being submitted that way. And so it's pretty hard to see those numbers increase. But we have seen a lot more women speaking at the conferences. And I think actually this year, I forget how many, but I think it's up like it's 17% or something like that. I think it's a good number of women speakers that are on the program.
As a conference organizer, how do you diversify that? Assuming diversifying the speaker lineup is a goal for you,
right,
what are some things that you've done that have worked or haven't worked? How do you start solving that problem?
Right. So the first piece is you make sure that your conference looks attractive and welcome. Like if like your initial lineup or if the language you use is off-putting or, you know, very clear that someone's not welcome or outsiders are not welcome, then that's a problem. And we have made sure that our language in our CFP and on our website is very inclusive that way. So, I mean, I think that's the first thing. You have to, as an organizer, you have to set the intention that this is important to you. And it is important. I think I like hearing from different types of people, not just from a gender or racial standpoint, but also from, you know, backgrounds, maybe economic, you know, success or whatnot. You know, I like hearing from all these different areas because that's interesting. You know, otherwise you just get the same old, you know, viewpoints, and it's nice to have a variety of that. So for me personally, that's important. I don't get why, or I certainly don't agree with the fact that these people aren't valuable or they don't have valuable things to say, because they absolutely do. So there's that part, the intention and making sure the language of the conference and the CFP, it makes it clear that these people are welcome. So the next step is outreach. If people, these different diversity groups are not aware of your proposal in your CFP and are not encouraged to participate, then most likely they won't. And so certainly the outreach is very important. And we work with other groups to kind of help get the word out. RubyConf and RailsConf, we don't do a lot of outreach in like marketing or whatever like that in terms of the conference. It's sort of like you just know about our conferences, and that's how you find out about the call if you're not following us on Twitter. We don't try to do anything more to get our conference out there. But in terms of the diversity standpoint, we do reach out to groups that that would be interested in helping carry the message beyond what our normal circle of reach is.
And has that helped?
Yeah, definitely. I think it was, I guess maybe it was last year, we got some complaints about the program for RubyConf. And part of it was we hadn't really done a lot. Like we just kind of let, traditionally the process has been very much the call is open. You know, there it is. Anyone interested can go out and get it, but we didn't do any promoting at all, not from any standpoint. And so we were sort of passive about it. And we had actually rolled out part of the program, and the initial part, the release of the program, had very few women involved. We actually had a number of women that were already accepted, but they hadn't confirmed. So we had only rolled out part of the program, but it made the program look even worse than it really was. And of course, then it led to a bit of a firestorm on Twitter. And so we realized we weren't really doing enough. And I mean, there wasn't any issues internally. Like we weren't, biased ourselves, or like, you know, we were already doing blind and we were already doing a number of things, but we hadn't done a lot of outreach. And it was foolish of us to roll out part of the program without being aware of how that would be perceived by the general community. And so anyway, we took a harder look at things and we made some changes. And the other piece that I would say that we do that's part of that is we have this opportunity scholarship. It was a program that I started at Rocky Mountain Ruby a number of years ago. I think it was 2012. And it was to give people access to the conference that normally wouldn't have gone. Maybe because financially they wouldn't be able to afford the conference. Maybe they don't feel welcome. Maybe they don't feel like they belong. We purposely would pick those people and give them a free ticket, as well as give them a guide. So it wasn't just about giving them free access to the conference, but also giving them sort of, hey, here's this person that you can get to know. You can ask the dumbest questions ever. You can be introduced to people. You can kind of get recommendations on talks and what to where to go at the conference, so you feel incredibly welcome. And so I started that in 2012, and I brought it to Ruby Central when I became a director. And I think that's really nice. And when I designed the program, I was going after women and people of color, anybody from a marginalized group that felt they weren't welcome, that we would say, no, you are. And matter of fact, here you go. Come to the conference and we'll show you around. And that program's done great. It's been very successful both at Rocky Mountain Ruby and at RubyConf and RailsConf. And we've also, Ruby Central has opened it up so that other conferences can do it as well. We kind of give them information about how to do it. We also help them pay for the conference registration. So we do, basically, we go meet them halfway so that it's not a complete financial burden for the conference that would be running it.
I love that idea of having a guide at the conference, especially if I've never been to one before and I don't know what to expect or what it's going to be like. And just knowing that there's someone who's more experienced, who's got my back, who's there to answer any questions I have, I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah, and certainly we've gotten great feedback on it. Every time we've asked, is there anything we can improve and all that, and both the guides and the scholars, we call them scholars, the people that have gotten the free ticket, they've been very appreciative, and they usually go on to give back and be more proactive. So like, I was a scholar, so now I'm going to reach out and help bring other people into it, into the conferences, and tell them how great it is. And it's been nice seeing that kind of pay it forward, as it were.
So I see a conference. I'm really excited to speak there. How do I write a good CFP?
You want to write a proposal, a title and abstract that's compelling, that is interesting. That, why should someone go to see this talk? What are they going to get out of it? These are all questions that an organizer is going to have when they look over your talk. You need to answer that either explicitly in an abstract, or usually CFP apps will give you like a details field or something to kind of explain stuff. We give a pitch field as well, so you can kind of explain why this talk is a good fit for the conference and why it should be let in. you know, where you maybe you want to highlight something that you don't want to give away in the abstract. So a lot of times what you want with an abstract is you want to say, you want to give them a hook. Like, this is really, really interesting. I want to go to this talk, but you don't give away the secret sauce. You don't give away whatever it is of what they're going to learn quite yet, but you allude to that so that someone's like, this is really interesting. I want to go see that. So that's kind of the first step. There should be something that's gained. Maybe you're going to challenge them on what they're thinking. Maybe you're going to help them work with some sort of gym or library or whatnot, or explore in some depth a way of a technique of building software or whatnot. So these are all things that you should think about when you're putting together your talk. You want to have an outline. Most people, when they put together a talk proposal, they don't course have the talk already written. They have an idea about that, but you want to make an outline to say, what exactly are you going to try to cover in this talk? Organizers oftentimes will want to see that, like, is this going to be really well organized, or maybe you're not going deep enough, or are you going too deep? You know, I mean, there's all, depending on what the topic is, an outline will help you kind of figure out what are you going to try to accomplish in the talk. And what can you really pull off? Like, if you spend only 2 minutes on this one thing, will that be enough to do it justice? Or are you going to be just kind of hand wavy on the, you know, in front of the audience? And it's kind of like, well, that wasn't really useful for them. So definitely thinking about what's the takeaway, what is the audience is going to get out of it. Good to identify that and communicate that in your proposal.
When I submitted to RailsConf and was looking at the instructions, it said, figure out what would be good for the audience and what's interesting to them. And my first thought was, well, I don't know the audience. I've never been to a tech conference before. I don't know who's going to be there. What are some good places to start looking for ideas? And how do you find out what's good for that particular audience?
Right. Probably one of the easiest thing is to, if the conference has previous years, go and read the previous year's program. Go and read what talks were accepted. Read those abstracts. If they have video, and a lot of conferences now post the videos of the talks online for free, you can go and watch those. So you could like look at a proposal that seems really interesting that someone gave a couple years ago. Maybe even watch it if you can, and then you can kind of connect the dots. So that's probably the easiest thing. I would say usually you want to write a talk that is of interest to you, that somebody would, like yourself, would want to see. If you learn, I mean, I guess you kind of have to investigate your audience, for sure, but I think that's a good place to start. If you feel like really passionate about, like, I have something I want to talk about and I want to share that with the greater community, that's pretty much like, that's that. Like, there you go. Now, see if you can shape that into a meaningful talk that lasts whatever, 30, 45 minutes, whatever the format is, and see if you can come up with something that you think would be compelling, would be interesting. And if you can, then that's, you know, you're on the right track. There are two resources that I'd recommend. We're kind of talking about the CFP process. One of them is called speaking.io. It's Zach Holman over at GitHub put this together. It's got a lot of great content there that can gets into the details of all kinds of aspects of putting together a proposal, as well as building a slide deck, and I think even speaking, actually the speaking process. Another one is a post that Justin Searles made at testdouble.com, and I'll give you the links to these so we can have them at the end of the show, in the show notes. But those two are great to look over and kind of refer to. I mean, I think the main thing is you have to have real good clarity about what you're trying to accomplish. It's just like with any sort of writing, it's like, what's your message? Is it clear? You know, do you have like an outline or a flow through, you know, your talk that's going to make sense? And then once you have that, then there is the, you know, you practice, you put your slides together, you practice in front of the mirror, or you record it yourself and you work through little small chunks, like talk over a slide or two. And I don't use a script personally, but essentially you get to where you feel comfortable talking about this and you practice it over and over and over again. And then, you know, you have sort of like a muscle memory, if you will, of doing that so many times that when you get on stage, you know, stage fright is normal, and hopefully, you know, all that repetition you have done will help you, you know, just lock in and just deliver the talk you've been practicing. You'll find what phrases you will you will use to describe this. And if you do it enough times, it totally, even if you don't write a script, I mean, you can write a script too, which is fine. But either way, you will settle in and you'll have these patterns that you will just, you'll just go to, and it'll work. I mean, and if it doesn't work, like if you're recording it, or like after you say it, you think, gosh, that was so awkward, I didn't like that at all. Or you give it to your significant other or whoever, and they either get it or don't get it. And it is good, by the way. You should practice these talks in front of a real audience. So like a local users group or whatever, before you actually go off to the conference to do it, you should definitely do that. I would recommend twice and tune it each time. Ask for feedback on what people got, what people didn't get, because sometimes your audience might not understand where you're going with something, and you realize you're missing a couple slides to keep that smooth, like that you don't lose them during the presentation. So,
yes, getting that feedback is really important. So, I learned something about myself from my last talk that I'd like to confess to you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
I was speaking to a group of architects, and the topic was something like making meaningful things. And halfway through my talk, I felt my left butt cheek twitch. And I realized that when I speak, the whole time I'm clenching my butt cheek so hard that the left one starts to twitch out of nervousness.
Wow. Well, there you go. Yeah, I mean, it's not really shocking, because depending on how comfortable you are with doing something, that your body language will go one way or another. And it is, by the way, this is kind of challenging. One of the first things that people usually struggle with is or other filler words that they don't really add any value, and they just kind of fill up the space. And you actually have to practice removing them and slowing down, not saying them. And along with that, body language, like how do you stand in front of the audience? You know, are you looking out at them? Are you staring at something? Are you fidgeting? Are you whatever it might be? Are your hands really busy and maybe in a distracting way? Or is your body language helping the proposal? And I mean, when you get into speaking and you try to, you know, eliminate those things, you will look more crucially at that. And there might be things like that where you're internalizing the stress, and it manifests in your body that way. And you're like, oh, I should probably do something about that. And, you know, you do what you can. But it's good to have awareness.
The good thing about my nervous twitch is that no one else can see it.
That's good. That would be maybe perhaps a bit embarrassing if they could.
So now we're going to do rapid fire fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Okay. Yeah.
Number one. Worst advice I've ever received is?
It's a collection of advice, pieces of advice I'd gotten mainly when I was in middle school and high school. And it was other students older than me telling me I would either hate a certain teacher or a class. And it turned out they were wrong. Like, they'd find out I had, you know, Mrs. Crow's English class, and I'm like, oh, you're so doomed and you're going to hate it. And I actually really liked that class. So it is the takeaway there is that you need to take that sort of advice with a grain of salt, because that may be true of someone's experience, but it may not be true for your own. And that's both on the good and bad, right? They might say you'll love this or you'll hate that, and they'll be wrong.
When I first told people that I was going to learn to code, the most common response I got was, oh, you're going to hate it. And it wasn't even from people who actually coded. So they were basing that on absolutely nothing.
Right.
Number two. My first app was about?
A random encounter generator for fantasy role-playing games.
That sounds complicated.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that complicated initially, but it did grow over time to be fairly complicated. And of course, totally, you know, labor of love, just, you know, a little script I'd written, and it was kind of tweaking over the years. So that's the first one.
Number three. One thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
Be curious and don't be afraid of trying to learn something complex and difficult. But with that, temper your expectations. So, you know, like, it's hard, but you're going to try. So striving to figure something out difficult is totally worth it. And don't be afraid of that, because certainly when I started, there were certain things, because I wasn't a comp sci. I didn't study computer science or anything like that in college. And so I was self-taught and coming about it that way. And there are certain things I thought, oh, I, course would have to go and study that in some college course or whatever before I could even touch that. And the reality is, no, not necessarily, although you would have to dig in and find some sort of good data on whatever it is. Like if you're trying to do compilers, you'd have to dig into kind of the same material. But don't be afraid of that, you know, dig in.
And now let's do some shout outs. Marty, you want to kick us off?
Okay. So the first is sort of under the theme of practicing your craft. Exorcism.io is a wonderful place to go. It's an app, library or a command line tool you can download where you can work on exercises in a number of different languages. Katrina Owen is the one who created that. And it's just great. You can get feedback through nitpicks that people give on your code that you are submitting, and it's just wonderful. Definitely great way for anyone, a code newbie or whatever, to practice building something that's small and doesn't take a ton of time, like a big app kind of thing, and gives you a lot of good feedback. And kind of following up with this, if you sort of get through all of Exorcism.io and you're in the Ruby space and you want to do some things, Ruby Quiz, which isn't being run anymore but was quite the thing for a long time, is out there. And there are lots of great exercises, quizzes, Ruby quizzes from years past that you can dig into and try to solve yourself. And you can find the solutions that other people submitted for it when you're ready to look at that. So those are two great things that you can use to practice your craft that has nothing to do with building practical application stuff. The next is mastering your editor. I'm going to shout out for Adam.io. If you're new to coding, having an editor that you're really comfortable with and that can help you write code is really crucial. You definitely want to become very comfortable and eventually master that. I recommend something very simple to begin with, and Adam is fits the bill. It's a great little editor. I use Sublime personally, but Adam's very, very similar to that. And you want to learn your keyboard shortcuts, try to be able to do things without using the mouse and all that. Eventually, when you get really good, you can kind of, you know, branch out into something like Vim or Emacs or whatnot. Assuming that this is the language, like a Ruby language or whatever that you're using that works with this editor. So Adam.io, and that's a great thing. Next would be Sandy Metz. Sandy is awesome, and you should definitely be aware of what she's doing. She's got some books out. I know a couple of them are in the works, and one of them's definitely out there, as well as she's got lots of videos. She's done at conferences, and she's doing workshops, so and she's got a neat blog too. So Sandy Metz, definitely worth checking her out. And the final one is a non-technical pick. It's the Outlander series. It's a historical fiction, kind of centered in the 18th century Scotland area, although it kind of moves around. It's by Diana Gabaldon. And my wife has read this series and is a huge fan of it for a long, long time. And she finally convinced me to start reading it. And I'm into the second book now. And it's very, very fascinating, very well written. You know, she's done a lot of research. And so you learn a lot about how it was back then, as well as the stories is very compelling and interesting. So the Outlander series.
Those were some great shout outs.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like those a lot. They're better than mine, so I'm kind of upset with you right now.
Oh, sorry. Maybe you should have gone first.
I know. That's what I'm going to do from now on. I'm going to go first so that the guests don't look better than me. So my first pick was going to be speaking.io, which you totally took during the interview. Right. It's okay. It's fine. But you should definitely check it out if you're interested in speaking. They have information on how to pick topics, how to actually write the CFP, how to speak, how to present your slides. A lot of really great information and really beautifully designed and laid out as well. So definitely check that out. My second shout out is a blog post called What I Learned from Reading 429 Conference Proposals by Noel Rappin, who was a conductor at RailsConf, and he reviewed CFPs for that conference. And he gives a lot of really, really great advice on things you should say, things you should not say, how you should format your talk and your proposal, things to make sure to include, and gives just a lot of really great feedback from the length of things to the types of language that you use. And I definitely think you should take a look at that before submitting your next proposal. My third shout out, going with the whole speaking theme, is called Lanyard, and it's a social conference directory. And you can go on there and search for topics, conferences, speakers, videos. You can also search for things like transcripts and sketch notes and slides. And it's a really great kind of one-stop shop for a whole lot of tech conferences on all different types of languages and frameworks. So definitely check that out, especially if you're looking for ideas and places to get started. If you want to join the conversation, you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for hashtag Code Newbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more on that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about, a guest you want to hear from, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Marty, so much for joining us. Do you want to say bye?
Oh, you're welcome. Yes, it is a pleasure. Thank you and goodbye, everyone.
And thanks for listening. See you next week.